in association with iFanboy. Welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Sundress. Today, pretty interesting conversation with Paul Kupperberg, a great DC writer that has an interesting past, but an even more interesting present, because he joins us to talk about my favorite book from 2010, Archie, The Married Life. In 2009, Archie Comics finally addressed the possibilities of what would happen if Archie chose Veronica over Betty, and vice versa. But the Michael Uslan miniseries was only the beginning. Archie the Married Life is a straight-up soap opera without ever losing the Archie charm and sentiment. Old-time characters are at the same time true to their Riverdale roots while facing adult problems that are heavier than who's going to the dance Saturday night. One of the Archie regulars even passed away in this December's issue. But despite the drama, there's still plenty of humor and satirical nods to modern pop culture that make this a great read month in and out. We talk about Paul's success taking over the adult Archie storyline and the publisher's fearless embrace of the modern comics era. From digital day-and-date release of brand-new monthlies, simultaneous with the direct store market at half the paper price, and the promise of more new titles and experimentation with the Archie brand. We also look back at some of Paul's memorable stories and characters at DC Comics, but we only scratch the surface. We talk about Killing Aquababy and Vigilante and Arion, Lord of Atlantis. Arion fans may also enjoy Paul's latest e-books, Two Tales of Atlantis and the anthology collection In My Shorts. We also talk about his stint as the editor of the Weekly World News. Lots to talk about with Paul Kupperberg, and again, we only scratch the surface in this edition of Word Balloon. It's brought to you today by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where they have a wide variety of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more, all from 38 to 42% off the standard retail price. Now, when it comes to Archie, InStock Trades has you covered with Archie the Married Life. You can get the hardcover edition of Archie Marries, 70 years in the making slipcase hardcover. The standard retail price was $24.95 at InStockTrades.com. It's just $18.71. Now, that's the Michael Uslan story. If you want to talk about Paul Kupperberg product at InStockTrades.com, some great DC books are waiting for you. For instance, Paul's take on Power Girl. The trade paperback that also includes Jeff Johns' great JSA classified story has Paul's showcase run from 97 through 99 and Secret Origins number 11. Paul Levitz, Paul Kupperberg, and Jeff Johns, the writers, Amanda Connor, Jimmy Palmiotti, Joe Staton, Dick Giordano, and Mary Wilshire, the artists. The standard retail price is $14.99 at InStockTrades.com, $9.29. How about Paul's work on Superman Family, specifically Nightwing and Flamebird? The Adventures of Nightwing and Flamebird from the 70s. The standard retail price is $19.99 at InStockTrades.com, $12.39. To check out all the details, and they've got a great new website with a wonderful, very easy-to-search interface, go there and check it out for yourself. InStockTrades at InStockTrades.com. First of all, congratulations on how great Archie the Married Life is. Because honestly, I was casually interested in the marriage arc that Michael Uslan did before you, but but I got to say, once things were up and running in your series, the soap opera really took off, and it's been so much fun watching all the little subplots move along, and the ideas of where these characters are going are just fabulous. Tell me about, like, the series Bible, for a lack of better word, in terms of the direction that you're taking the series in, how much of it was your input, how much of a game plan you were given when you were handed this assignment?
Well, a lot of what I was given was, you know, of course, what had already happened in the original miniseries. And then the follow-up document, the Bible, kind of gave a general direction for the characters. The miniseries was kind of an overview of what it was like to be married to Betty and or Veronica. And now we were going back pretty much like 6 months after the weddings or so, and picking up from scratch. So we were going to fill in all the gaps in Mike's overview, the original miniseries. But beyond that, I wasn't really given a lot of details. A lot of it was left to me to develop and work out, other than, again, things that Michael had set up. Most of the subplots were pretty much my doing. You know, I was just took off from what Mike had done and went from there.
Well, they're very hilarious choices, and some of them you'd never would think of. And I got to start with my favorite, and that's Moose, of all people, running for mayor of Riverdale. That's fantastic.
Yes. Well, you know, you kind of look for things that'll go against type. You know, and with Moose certainly going into politics did not seem like a very obvious choice. You know, I found that the characters do a lot of very surprising things. You know, I try to develop these stories, and my favorite child in the whole thing is Reggie. He has just developed into the best character. You know, I keep trying to mess with him, but he won't let me. You know, he keeps coming back with, you know, with dignity and poise and handling the situations. And, you know, so as much as I'm trying to screw with him, it just ain't happening. He's taking it. You know, all the stuff in these characters is, you know, there's 70 years worth of development. And you know, once you get into them at this level, you find out how really beautifully constructed they are.
Well, and you're right. And I think the turns that they are taking are surprising for us readers as well. And you're right. I think you've redeemed Reggie in a very interesting way in both story arcs, because he is the sympathetic shoulder that Veronica can cry on through her own frustrations being married to Archie, but conflicted with her feelings for her father and wanting to do right by what her father thinks is right. And you know, Reggie is there to be a good guy of all things. The cat is being a good guy. And then on the flip side, you know, you've got him in a situation that I think a lot of people out of college can appreciate of, you know, I'm not the guy that I thought I was in high school. I was the big man on campus, and now I'm kind of, you know, left in that post-college, you know, frustration that I think a lot of us go through in their 20s in terms of who am I? And that's become a very interesting story. And I can't wait for the arc that's coming up with the trial of Reggie. Reggie York or Reggie Van York? I always forget if there's a van in there.
It's Reggie Mantle.
Oh, Reggie Mantle. Excuse me. Of course it is. That's a shame on me.
yes, the trial of Reggie Mantle is ongoing. I mean, I'm currently writing the number 10. You know, number 6 is on the stands, but I'm already, you know, working a few months ahead.
Fantastic.
You know, and number 11, I think, is where we're really going to, you know, hit the courtroom.
That's great. And also, wait, now back to Moose for a second, because I love Moose's new girlfriend. I couldn't help but think of Alicia Masters from the Fantastic Four continuity, in that he has found this blind yoga instructor who has no preconceived notions of what Moose physically represents and what he's always represented in the comics, and, you know, helps bring out this inner Moose, as I think you even said in the story, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if Michael set that up on purpose.
Very cool. Very cool. You know,
he's a big fan, you know, of all that stuff, especially, you know, of the old comics, you know, what we call the good stuff. And so, you know, this would not surprise me.
That's great. Well, you know, I'm curious what kind of feedback you've gotten from adult readers, because, you know, it's great. I've been able to pass this on to tweeners. And what I love about it is I think it's a fun soap opera that you can hand to, you know, a kid, you know, a reasonably mature kid, and they can get a lot out of it. And I think it's a lot of fun reading. And I can only speak for myself and say, for an adult reader that hadn't read Archie in a long time, it was easy to get back to these characters and see them and recognize them for what they were. And so much fun to read them as adults. And it is one of my go-to books every month. I look forward to it every month and enjoy every chapter.
Thank you.
It's been a great ride, man. So, yeah, what kind of feedback?
I appreciate hearing that. You know, we've gotten we've been getting really great feedback on it. You know, I mean, I don't talk to a lot of people because, you know, I'm a writer. I basically spend a lot of time alone in a room. But online, I have seen the reviews and blogs and stuff, and it's been really gratifying. The response has been great, and I wrote it intentionally to be accessible to kids and to adults. I mean, you know, I know our market is primarily 12-year-old girls, but we also wanted something, because of all the attention that the marriage stories got, we wanted something that was, that adults were going to be able to pick up on as well, because we thought, you know, they thought at long last, adults are actually going to be picking up on the book. So here's our opportunity to hook them.
For people who haven't been reading, I'm going to cliff note and then you fill in any gaps that I'm missing. It, as you said, it's two stories that are happening at the same time, but are different forks down memory lane, or up memory lane, I guess, as you guys put it, in the future. Archie, in one scenario, married to Veronica, is a junior executive for Mr. Lodge. And you'd think he would be happy that he gets Veronica and everything, but things are obviously tough. In the other story, he is a struggling musician with Betty, living in Greenwich Village. And, money's always a problem with these guys. And in that story, a very heartbroken Veronica has, you know, kind of not gotten over, you know, losing Archie. And what I've loved is the despicable Mr. Lodge kind of coming to Archie with the choice of, man, I'll tell you, if you want your problems to go away, if you dump Betty, I'll make all your financial problems, both of yours, go away. And all you have to do is break up with Betty. But, I mean, as broke as they are, they're very happy together. And in right. And in the other situation, Veronica and Archie are, you know, truly love each other, but they're certainly having these personality conflicts that we mentioned before, where Reggie's kind of been the sympathetic shoulder that Veronica can lean on, but in a very platonic way.
Right. Well, you know, I kind of think of the storylines in this way. The Veronica stories, is the theme is always, you know, money can't buy happiness, and in the Betty story, the theme is love solves everything.
Very nice.
You know, so you kind of play them that way. I mean, you know, the financial business. I'm into the second story arc here. And in fact, just met yesterday with gee whiz, everybody at Archie and Michael Uslan to talk about the third upcoming story arc and plans beyond that that are actually pretty damn exciting.
Cool.
There's a lot going on.
Jughead is helping out Pops at the chocolate shop, and is suffering in his own financial problems, but also kind of finding out the man that he really is. And the great thing is, we mentioned Moose and his girlfriend. I mean, you guys, like, really, again, you know, I kind of picked up on the second story arc when you started writing. Was shocked to learn that Midge and Moose had broken up over his anger issues. And finally, Jughead gets Midge. And that's been a very sweet little story, too, where it started off as kind of what seemed to be a relationship of convenience. Where maybe if Jughead got, you know, if they got married, it was like, well, we'll save on taxes. And it seemed like kind of a anything but love kind of arrangement. And then finally, when, you know, push came to shove, Midge is like, wait a minute, I'm not going to just marry if you don't love me. And he's like, you know, well, of course I love you. And it was this very sweet little moment between Jughead and Midge.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, Jughead is the least demonstrable human being in the face of the earth. You know, he's never going to come out and say, I love you to somebody, certainly to a girl, ick, you know.
Right.
So, this is, again, I'm just extrapolating, you know, how would these characters that, you know, I've known for so long, you know, how would they react in these grown-up situations? It's been very easy to work them, you know, to work with them, because they react exactly as they're supposed to, you know.
Yeah. Well, and then of course at Christmas time, what a bitter pill to serve to the country, and it got picked up on a lot of news services and stuff, and I mean, you pretty much telegraphed what was coming, but it was very shocking that after finally finding each other, Miss Grundy and Mr. Weatherby admitting to each other their love for each other, but poor Miss Grundy has cancer and passes away, and we
actually never named the disease.
Oh, okay.
People have gone on with cancer. I deliberately didn't name any disease.
Okay.
But yes, she did die. You know, I am a serial killer, a comic book serial killer, because in my career in the 70s, I killed Aqua Baby,
yes,
Aquaman's son. And in the 80s, I killed Vigilante.
The Adrian Chase Vigilante, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And now I've lost Miss Grundy. Stop me or Marmaduke is next.
Well, I was there for all three of them, Paul, and I got to tell you, absolutely, man. No, longtime DC reader, and was just happened to be there at the wrong time, I guess, to see poor Miss Grundy get it. But I want to talk about, in particular, the Adrian Chase character a little bit later, because that was such a great series, and it really was one of the best, I think, direct market early, you know, mid-'80s series and stuff. And I always thought that was very emotional, and that death in particular really was quite disturbing.
Yeah.
In a very, you know, very creative, yeah, effective way. So,
good. It worked.
but back to the light stuff for a second. I want to, and actually, again, I mean, the great thing was, you know, poor Miss Grundy, you know, has to tell Mr. Weatherby after they each profess their love for each other, hey, you know, I'm dying, so maybe this isn't a great idea. And much like Jughead and Midge, you know, Mr. Weatherby's like, well, there's only one thing we can do. And she's looking sad and expecting the kiss off and everything. And he's like, no, we got to get married.
Right.
So, yeah, this is, I mean, it's that right, I think, blend of the kind of sentimentality that you expect from Archie Comics. But again, it is in the backdrop of these very, you know, soap opera-y kind of real life problems. And it's really, you've got a good, delicate touch, man. I really think that, again, I think.
Well, you know, again, I've been given a lot of great material to work with, you know, the characters, the initial storyline. You know, people always ask the question, you know, where do you get your ideas? And it's, well, you know, that's my job. you know, so these things are fun to do when I'm working with this great group of characters. I mean, you know, and they're very, it is personal. I remember when I was sitting, when I was writing the death, you know, when Weatherby comes out and says, you know, Geraldine is dead. I got choked up and I had to stop and you know, walk away from the computer, because I got very choked up. And I was staying at a friend's house at the time, and I went out and I was talking to him, and I said, man, it's weird. I was writing, Miss Grundy just died, and I got all emotional over it. And he reacted. He went, wow, no, now that you mention it, yes, I'm choked up too. You know, she's been around forever. She's 70 years in everybody's consciousness. You know, everybody always talks about the recognition of comic books. They're always talking about Superman and Batman and Spider-Man and, you know, the superheroes. But man, you want to talk about universal recognition? You know, Archie and the gang, including minor characters like Miss Grundy and Mr. Weatherby, have greater recognition than anybody other than maybe, you know, Superman and the Daily Planet staff.
Absolutely. And, you know, we have a lot of old-time radio that plays in Chicago. And over the Christmas season, they played a couple episodes of Archie. And you forget what kind of national institution truly Archie was. And that even in those pre-television years, I mean, there were very few comic characters that had their own weekly, you know, series, whether it would be a sitcom or an adventure. But Archie was certainly one of them. And it had, a very lengthy radio run, not to mention the comic strips and the magazines that have always managed to stay on newsstands and in other venues outside of comic books direct market a lot longer than the superhero stuff has. And, of course, it's resulted in higher circulation and higher sales, I think, across the board than your average superhero comic book. People forget that. And I was glad to see that the Archie Company in particular kind of very casually last year mentioned, oh, by the way, if you didn't know, as these superhero comics kind of struggled to crack 100,000, you guys hit a quarter of a million consistently with your titles. And I think that's terrific. And again, it just shows that a lot more people are reading Archie than I think the average superhero comic book reader would suspect.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, and the main reason for that is going to be accessibility. I mean, they're out there. You can pick them up in a lot of outlets that don't carry other comics. You know, they've always had really good. So the digests, you know,
yes.
they were groundbreakers with these things. You know, getting them into the supermarkets at the checkout stands you know, so these guys have been, you know, very quietly but consistently ahead of the game in a lot of ways, which, you know, even I with, you know, 35 years in the business and, you know, a lot of experience in the editorial and business side of comics, you know, never really realized.
And as we're recording today, there was a big announcement that several of the Archie comics will be going to Day and Date, both on the stands and also digitally. And mm-hmm. and I think that's terrific. And at a very fair price, too, $1.99 digitally. And also, by God, The Married Life. I buy the magazine format, by the way, which, know. So, yeah, it's kind of embarrassing being a man in his 40s and carrying around a magazine with Justin Bieber on the cover. But here I am.
Yeah, well, you know, that's... That's the price we pay.
Understood
it. But again, you know, we're talking about the primary audience, 12-year-old girls, you know.
And I'm right there with them in the front row.
I mean, I would like to see a little less Justin and a little more, you know. Anything else?
That's all right. That's okay. No, it really is. It's again, The Married Life in particular, I really do enjoy it. But really all the Archie books, I give them a lot of credit for finding the humor again and relating to pop culture. We had the Sarah Palin Obama issue just come out in the last couple months.
Right.
And the
Kevin Keller storyline was humongous for them.
First gay Archie character, Kevin Keller, correct? Yes.
Yeah. You know, and as a matter of fact, we were talking yesterday again about the next story arc and that which is to follow. And you know, it was myself and Victor Gorlick and Mike Pellerito and John Goldwater and you know, so we were all sitting in a room with Michael Uslan on speakerphone, working out some of the ideas and how we'll be tying in with other things that'll be happening. You know, it's just an amazing amount of stuff is happening at that company. And, you know, they see things. There were two things suggested at the time, you know, that were brought up for the first time in the room yesterday and with a few nods between these three guys sitting there, new books and miniseries were approved. You know.
Very cool.
Like, they're moving. They're just, you know.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah,
these guys at the head of the company. Now they've been there for a long time, and I think that's pretty interesting that they are kind of, you know, willing and obviously succeeding by changing with the times. And I think presenting Archie stories that do fit the era. And it's because, you know, I mean, Archie's had its peaks and valleys in terms of, I think, creativity. Always great artists and everything, and I think good attempts at trying to, you know, stay current and with the times, but I really do think there is this new burst of energy and I think a real opportunity to connect to this audience. And, you know, people who listen to my show are really interested in the comic book business as much as the stories themselves. And I really do think that Archie is the sleeping giant that really isn't sleeping and actually, as you say, very quietly making the right moves to represent themselves in the different digital platforms, but also from an editorial standpoint to give us fresh entertainment that still feels like Archie, but is, I think, you know, kind of, you know, in tune with what's going on today.
Right. And interestingly, I find that, you know, I walked into the Archie Christmas party this year and it looked like, I felt like I was at a DC Comics Christmas party in 1986. There were guys there who I've known, you know, from Joe Staten, who I've known since the mid-70s, through, you know, Al Milgrom and Bob Smith and Janice Chang you know, I mean, just Todd Smith, who was, you know, I worked with on Vigilante.
Cool.
He's drawing Archie comics too. You know, Norm Breyfogle on Married Life is,
yes,
you know, Batman artist, for God's sake. You know? But these guys are all really good cartoonists, You know, they're not comic book artists. They're cartoonists. And Norm has done a brilliant job on the Archie characters in the Married Life. It's just dead on Archie characters, but you know, with all that kind of action and activity that Norm brought to the superhero comics, it's really great stuff. But there's all these guys there. You know, I'm working with all my old buddies, from DC, from the olden days. But we're all doing, you know, we're all new to Archie or newish to Archie, and so we're all doing brand new stuff. You know,
and it must be great to really find yourself in this kind of work environment too, where, you know, you can really come up with new ideas. And it's not like you're reaching back on things you did with Aryan or World of Krypton
totally,
and stuff. Yeah.
No, I walked out of there with a mini series that will likely lead to an ongoing series approved. Another continuity driven Archie book. And was told to start writing scripts. So,
fantastic.
And it's got nothing. Well, it's historically driven. It's a book that will kind of show the history of Riverdale through the families, you know, through the Lodge and Andrews families.
Oh, interesting.
So I don't know when it's going to be out, but Victor told me to start writing. It's different. I mean, you know, the Married Life is really the first continuity-driven title that Archie has ever launched.
Sure.
There's never been a continuity-driven Archie title before.
Right.
So the fact that they're willing to go forward with another one is a very good sign.
That's terrific.
Another chance that they're willing to take. So.
Well, and further, I think, killing off a character like Miss Grundy, I mean, you anytime they do that, you are, I think, as a reader, left with, well, if they're willing to do that, no one is safe, or what could possibly come next?
And we have figured out what will be coming next, it's not death, but it should be shocking.
Interesting. I also love, and it was mentioned at the very early stages of, I want to say, your arc, that we've got Dilton Doily, the science character of the stories and stuff, is very mysterious. And this is kind of a nod to the superhero worlds, where we're dealing with parallel universes. And he was postulating the existence of parallel universes when he mysteriously disappeared. And I think people with a keen eye have kind of seen him pop in and out of stories at opportune moments. So I imagine that might be something that might be developing as the story progresses.
Indeed. I would say that readers should watch out for issue 13 through 18.
Wow.
Crisis on Infinite Archies. So.
Is that really what it's called?
No, but it's...
that's outstanding.
Going to have elements of that.
Fantastic.
Dilton's multiverse is coming back, and it's going to be real interesting.
That's fantastic. You know, honestly, little things like Big Ethel. Big Ethel finally, like, can drop the big, you know, nickname and stuff, and now she's just Ethel. And she's even, you know, another interesting subplot with her intended kind of in business with Mr. Lodge. And, she wants to do the right thing. I mean, that's the thing. I think the gang is all still, like, you know, trying to help each other out as a close-knit group of friends who, as they age, you know, still manage to find time and stay together and stuff would.
Yeah.
You know,
well, in fact, the script I'm working on now is the Betty story for number 10. And it's called Fourth Down. And the whole story is set at the park on Sunday morning in the fall where they're having a touch football game. You know, this is like the only chance they all get to get together anymore. So they all the drama is related around or through flashbacks at the football game. At the park. So, you know, it's real important that I keep showing that relationship, because that's really, you know, ultimately what the book is all about.
The Archie website is also very impressive, and I was really surprised at the multimedia, first of all, that's there. I think it's terrific. And and I'm wondering, you know, is there things planned? Do you have little chats or anything with the online community? Do you guys set up anything like that with the fan base, or how much?
Not to my knowledge, but, you know, I was speaking to Archie's PR guy yesterday when I was up there, and to Alex, and you know, told him, you know, happy to do anything, you know, chats or interviews, so perhaps we'll see some.
Excellent. Yeah, Alex Segura, who used to be with DC.
Another ex-DC.
There you go.
You know, Archie's becoming the place to be.
That's very cool, man. Well, like I said, I truly do. I mean, when I heard that Alex was jumping over to Archie, because I've been meaning to talk to somebody from Archie since the Married Life was happening, and when Alex made the jump, I immediately got a hold of him and said, hey, get me the writer, because I'm enjoying this book. And truly, it was my favorite series from 2010. I have to say that reading that story, it absolutely is a go-to book every month, and I am literally as excited as I am with certain crime and superhero books to find out what's happening next in Riverdale. So, it's a great, great series. And Married Life will be one of those books that will be available digitally as well.
It'll be available digitally. The collected, you know, graphic novels are coming out. I wrote afterwards for the first volumes of both a while back, so those should be coming out soon. It's going to be available widely and in many formats.
That's fantastic. I was also a little concerned, and I'm glad to hear, and actually even reading the last issue, I knew that everything was going to be okay. But I guess little jinxes, actually, I know there have been a couple one-page stories here and there, as they were back in the day. You know, but I was almost afraid that like the focus was going to go to Little Jinx. I'm like, oh no, I want new Little Jinx stories, and I'm curious about those as well. But was glad to see that obviously, like we've been saying, the trial of Reggie is kind of the next story arc. But if you didn't read the first one after the Married Life, folks, you're really missing out. It's a great great setup for obviously what's to come. But I'm glad to see that Married Life will continue, and there are still plenty of stories that.
Oh, I could go on and on and on with these stories. There's just no end. In fact, one of the things we talked about yesterday was, could I tone it down a little and cut them a little slack? You know, the Archie characters. And it's like, well, I could, but then it really wouldn't be melodrama, would it? You know.
No, I think I'm all for keeping the melodrama, because it really is. It's great seeing them kind of go through it. And yeah, I mean, you are. You've been giving them great moments of triumph over these obstacles. So I think that makes it, you know, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It really, I mean, and that's the thing. Believe me, I've been telling other adult friends, you wouldn't believe what's happening with Archie these days. And you tell them, and they're like, their mouths are hanging open. It's like, get out of here. And I've lent it to their children, and they wind up reading it themselves and are like, oh my God, poor Jughead, poor Pops getting squeezed out by, I mean, that's the thing. You've got Pops being squeezed out by these big chain, franchises like Johnny Rockets and things. Although you've come up with great euphemisms for some of these recognizable names like Starbucks or Johnny Rockets.
Yeah.
But that's great.
I even had Reggie working at a Dunk-a-Muffin, I think.
Poor Reggie. Yes. Yeah. But that's the great thing. It's fun to see them dealing with these real life problems. And I would say keep the melodrama up. It's fantastic. Thought we'd take a break right here. We'll get back to more of our conversation with Paul Kupperberg in just a couple minutes. But right now is an opportunity to tell you about a new feature at Word Balloon, and I want you to take advantage of it, and that's the Word Balloon Hotline. I finally set up a listener line that people can call in, ask questions of Word Balloon, and also give us your two cents on what you think of not only the conversations you hear here, but also about the comic book news that's going on in the websites and what the publishers are up to. It's your chance to get direct feedback on the Word Balloon program. So here's the phone number to call. It's open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The number is 312-841-7025. 312-841-7025. It's at our website as well, wordballoon.com. But feel free to leave us a message. Tell us your name and where you're calling from and what's on your mind when it comes to comics. I certainly want to hear from you. It's the Word Balloon Hotline. Check it out. Now, I know you're also working on some ebooks, and I wanted to take a moment and talk about those because I had a chance to read through In My Shorts in particular and was pleased to find out that Reflected Glory, one of your stories in My Shorts, I had read it 15 years ago when it was part of the Superheroes Anthology.
Right.
And which is a collection of prose stories featuring superheroes. And I remember it well. And you're in good collected company in that anthology with guys like Danny O'Neill and others of your former co-workers over at DC and other companies. Reading in the preface was couldn't help but notice the similarities to Hancock in a certain way.
Yeah, just slightly. I mean, you know premise-wise and all.
PR guy, put in charge of helping a superhero.
Well, a PR guy who, out of gratitude for having his life saved by this recalcitrant superhero, offers to help him reform his image, and hilarity ensues. The stories diverge at a certain point.
Sure.
But the basic premise was very similar, and yes, I had been contacted by a producer. At the studio, and but there was a one-time conversation, never heard back from him, and then 12 years later, Hancock comes out. I spoke to an attorney, an IP attorney.
Sure.
And he said you could probably prove it, but you can't afford to. So.
I just had Steve Englehart on last year talking about the similarities to one of his Batman stories, to The Dark Knight specifically, and
sure.
And that he was one of those creators that didn't get a check from DC. And, certainly the name of Art Buchwald in Coming to America came up in our conversation,
right.
In the same scenario there. And for people who didn't hear the episode, the Washington columnist Art Buchwald proved in court that the Eddie Murphy film Coming to America was based on his idea that he had submitted years earlier. And then, of course, when it came time to pay him, Paramount proved in that typical accounting sort of way of Hollywood
right.
that, no, they didn't make a dime off that movie that grossed over $300
right.
million. Dollars, so,
that's right.
Let's all shrug and, thanks a lot.
Hey, listen, I would have been happy with, go away money, but what are you going to do?
I hear you. Well, the great thing about In My Shorts is it's an ebook, and it has it has several short stories in it, Reflected Glory being one of them. But Stone for the Grave of Mr. Aronson?
Yes. It's just a little, kind of mood piece that I wrote. It's just my in-laws are buried at a cemetery, and there was a little grave nearby theirs, a little lonely footstone for Sidney Aronson. And, every time I was there was never, at Jewish cemeteries, you leave a pebble or a stone on top of the headstone or
sure.
a gravestone to show that somebody was there, so it's kind of an indication that people have been visiting, and because in the Jewish tradition, you're supposed to take care of people even after death. So there was never a stone there, so I started putting a stone on his grave, and I just thought, it kind of the phrase "a stone for the grave of Mr. Aronson" stuck in my head, and I started writing that story one day. So
very cool. And then two in particular that I haven't had a chance to read yet, but I'm interested in both of them. First, Man Bites Dog, and I had no idea that you had spent a little time at the Weekly World News before it folded.
Yes, I was executive editor and writer at Weekly World News for its last year and a half. Best gig I ever had.
What's that like? I mean, certainly we've all seen it on the supermarket racks back in the day.
Yeah,
but yeah,
it was. It was six of us in little cubicles in a grungy office in Manhattan. In this tabloid, bankrupt tabloid company, and morally and otherwise. And the paper was produced by the editor in chief, Jeff Roven, who you might know from Comic Book Days.
Yeah, didn't Jeff Roven, wasn't he with Martin Goodman's Second Atlas back in the 70s?
Yes, he was that, and then he's written numerous books on nonfiction books on movies and films, and co-written star biographies, Ernest Borgnine and guys like that.
Gotcha.
But he was also one of the guys. He did Tom Clancy, one of the Tom Clancy series, the Op Center he wrote those for a while. So, you know, he's but anyway, he was, you know, editor-in-chief, and then there was me, and then there was managing editor Bob Greenberger, also from DC Comics.
Sure.
And then there was the art director and the designer, both of whom also stole from DC. and then a guy named Dick Siegel, who was an actual Weekly World News writer before we ever got there. But yeah, we pretty much put out the magazine ourselves every 48 pages every week, the five of us. With writers, of course.
Certainly. Well, you know, so you were giving us the adventures of Bat Boy and some of these other...
Bat Boy and Matt Damon, Demon Hunter, and Miss America, America's Gayest Hero. it was great stuff. I mean, it was just, there was nothing too insane to propose for an article, you know. Like, I'd go, they found the map that Moses dropped at the edge of the Red Sea. That's a story, you know?
Hey, man, one of my favorites before your tenure there was Clinton pushing around John F. Kennedy, who has been wheelchair and, of course, been alive since 63 and stuff. And, yeah, it was...
Well, you know, never forget that the concept of Elvis sightings was born in the Weekly World News.
I did forget that. All right, that's
great. Yes. So no, this had an almost 30-year run. It was a crime that paper couldn't be maintained because it was you know, I think as much an institution as MAD.
Sure.
But based on my kind of experience and extrapolating crazily and wildly beyond it, I wrote that short story "Man Bites Dog" for an anthology published by Moonstone Books. And it's about a reporter for the Weekly World News in a world where all the stuff they report is true, which, of course, nobody believes anyway. So, you know, everybody thinks it's all fake news. He's sent to a little small town in West Virginia to investigate vampire attacks and winds up having fun and interesting times.
Very cool. You know, I was going to ask, and it makes sense now. I know for a while they might still have it. Moonstone had the Kolchak license.
Yes.
And I almost wonder if, you know, given your background and stuff, that you'd be perfect to write some Kolchak stories, too.
I write a bit for Moonstone. I've done short stories for several of their anthologies, The Avenger and Green Hornet, and I write Captain Action stories for them.
I saw that in your bio. That's very cool.
Yeah. So I do a bit of those things. You know, it's fun. You get to play with all these wacky, offbeat characters. Although, in the case of Man Bites Dog, that's my wacky, offbeat character.
Understood. You know, I can't help but think, too, in today's television reality series world, and even parodies of reality series, I noticed The Onion is certainly out there now with their shows, that Weekly World kind of just barely missed the window of opportunity to kind of mount something like that.
Oh yeah, there was. Well, you know, it's a long story, and we can do another talk about it, and I can tell you how, you know, all the licensing and merchandising that I was lining up for Weekly World News, including action figures and books
I remember an IDW Bat Boy series being announced a couple of.
That was post. That was from the guys who picked up the rights to Weekly World News after American Media folded it.
Understood. Okay. So, okay. Yeah, I would like to hear about that at some point, though.
Yeah.
And actually, I would think that would make a hell of a book, actually, The Last Days of Weekly World News.
Or not.
Well, and the other story in there, Hitler's Bellboy, as you call it, the Jerry Lewis film that was never made but probably should have been.
Yes.
And, you know, I got to say, Which Way to the Front is one of my favorite painful Jerry Lewis movies to watch. And,
yeah, there's Which Way to the Front, and, of course, there's the classic The Day the Clown Cried.
Yes.
Which is Jerry playing a clown who's put in a concentration camp and is used to be the Pied Piper to lure the children into the gas chambers. And it's partially filmed. I mean, this was back in the 60s or 70s.
Yes.
Partially filmed, but he never raised the money to finish it, and then there were rights issues over the scripts and all that of the script. But you know, knowing and I love Jerry Lewis. I love Jerry Lewis. I admire him. I think he's a brilliant comedian. He is so influential on my life. It's positively I really should be put away. I love Jerry Lewis, but you know, I recognize his flaws. And one of his flaws is he does not recognize he has any flaws.
And, sure.
You know, if you read enough about him, you'll see common themes, and I kind of played off those in this little thing. But Hitler's bellhop is scenes from a screenplay that he supposedly wrote because all the great comedians had their Hitler pictures. Chaplin had his Hitler picture, and Mel Brooks has his Hitler picture. He wanted his Hitler picture, so he went home and he wrote Hitler's bellhop, in which, out of gratitude for stumblingly, accidentally saving his life, Hitler rewards the Jerry Lewis bellhop character with the position of bellhop. Hitler's personal bellhop. And in my movie, in my screenplay, Hitler is played by Gail Gordon. So he's
Mr.
not a
Moody
nasty
from
Hitler.
The Lucy Show.
Yes. Yes. Oh, Miss Ricardo. And Tony Randall is, you know, plays FDR. And I mean, it's all 1960s casting. And Jerry Colon as Stalin, you know, he had the mustache.
He did have Stalin's mustache. That's cool. That's a good point.
Yeah. So I was having lunch with, this is back in the 90s, having lunch with a friend, Brian Augustin, another fellow editor and writer at DC.
Absolutely.
And we were just hanging around and we started riffing on this concept of, you know, what would be the most tasteless Jerry Lewis movie. And we finally settled on Hitler's bellhop and, you know, we threw a few things around and I started writing, and I did, you know, a bunch of scenes, and then I wrote this essays that supposedly, you know, from a film journal about the lost screenplay, and you know, nobody is publishing this thing because it's called Hitler's Bellhop. So I figured I'd just publish it myself.
That's cool. Now, and you have another ebook as well, and it's two
Tales of Atlantis.
Two Tales of Atlantis. Now. First, I want to talk about the book, and then we'll backtrack and talk about Arion, because one of the stories, as you say in your preface, for people who were fans of the Arion series, can enjoy one of these stories and put, you know, Arion, you know, you'll say it better. So by all means, explain.
Well, it's essentially, you know, while the characters have different names, and some of the ways I've handled Atlantis and the history of the whole thing are different, this is essentially, you know, it's called Walk Upon the Waters, and it's essentially the last Arion story. It's, you know, if I were finishing up the original run of Arion when I wrote that, story, this is the way I would have handled it. And, you know, and I have characters who are analogous to the Arion cast in that as well. And then that was published in an anthology called Oceans of Magic in the early 2000s. And then for another anthology, I wrote a story called Past Lives, about a this sword and sorcery world character woman who wakes up one morning to realize that she's actually the reincarnated warrior of, you know, the lover of the Arion character.
Understood.
Except she's, you know, middle-aged mother of 10 and lives on the farm. And, you know.
Hilarity ensues.
She's heard about it, you know. But now she has to go act on it. And there's, you know, there's a war going on, and she has to go look for her sorcerer lover. And, you know.
That's terrific.
And what happens?
No, that's really cool. Now, you're selling these as ebooks.
Yes.
So where would we find these online? How would we be able to purchase these?
You can either purchase them through my website at buffaloavenuebooks.blogspot.com, or you can go to smashwords.com, which is what I'm publishing them through, and you can just do a search for my name, and you'll find my books there.
Okay. That's cool. And like I said, what I've read, I've really enjoyed, and I am
Thank
a fan
you.
Of Arion, so I'm looking forward to really sitting down and seeing how the story wraps up. Going back to Arion, was that part of Joe Orlando's sword and sorcery kind of mystery books that were coming out in the 70s of DC, or was it a different publishing
this
initiative?
This was a little later. This was it started as a backup in Warlord. Whatever backup had been running was ending for whatever reason, and they were looking for a new backup feature, so I came up with Arion and pitched it to Laurie Sutton, who was the editor at the time.
Okay.
And she bought it, and we got it through, and Jan Dersima came on board and drew the very, very pretty pictures.
Absolutely.
And it ran for, I think it ran for about 43, 44 issues in the 80s.
Very cool. And Jan Dersima of late was collaborating with John Ostrander on the Star Wars books.
Yes.
And they were such
Jan
an effective
team.
Jan has
become known widely for the Star Wars work she's been doing for the last bunch of years. She kind of made her bones on Arion and was always happy to have her there.
That's really cool. I are there any collections of the Arion stuff?
There is not, and I'm kind of baffled. Like I was in a comic shop recently, and I was looking at the action figures, and they've got Gem's Son of Saturn action figure.
Yes,
and I'm thinking, wow, Gem's Son of Saturn was the lowest selling comic book in DC history.
Really?
Okay? It sold 9%. It was one of the early direct market books.
Yes.
And it sold 9%.
Ugh.
In sell through. And he's got an action figure, but there's no Arion action figure. No Checkmate Arion. Checkmate action figure.
Well, that's surprising, and I wanted to talk about Checkmate, but first with Gem, I guess James Robinson was, or the creator of Gem was fortunate enough that James Robinson decided to bring him back for that.
No, nothing to do with it.
Well, no, but I'm saying
back to a guy named Greg Potter.
Oh, no, I understand that. What I was going to say, though, is James just used Gem recently in Superman in World of New Krypton.
Yes, but Arion has shown up in Superman recently, and
that's
Checkmate
true.
Is kind of the backbone of Identity Crisis and all that.
Oh,
stuff,
absolutely,
so.
Yes.
Anyway, I'm not bitter. I'm just merely pointing these things out.
Well, I'll tell you too. I loved Checkmate back in the day. I really loved the design of the knights and the action outfits that they had. It was
those were designed by John Byrne.
Well, there you go. Not too shabby. Okay.
Yeah.
Was he your artist, or did he just come up with the artist designs, the conceptual designs?
Yeah, he just came on to do the conceptual designs.
Okay, okay,
man. Steve Irwin was the artist originally.
Okay, yeah, man.
He had been working with me on the last few issues of Vigilante, and Checkmate spun out of that. That went down.
Was there any connection? Did DC have the license to the old Checkmate Detective series or anything like
that? No. No, but I think Checkmate's one of those titles that you can kind of, I mean, titles are tough to protect.
Sure.
Like that. So, that had nothing to do with it. Although I do have the issues of the Gold Key comic version of the old Sebastian Cabot TV show.
Doug McClure. Absolutely.
Doug McClure and Sebastian Cabot.
Yes. Yeah, I just grabbed actually over Christmas a DVD collection that had about 6 episodes of Checkmate on it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's the 150 crime series crime shows. Yeah, it's collected with those, and I haven't had a chance to watch them yet, but I've been looking forward to it. I've been curious. So, very cool. Well, and your Checkmate, like you say, yeah, is certainly a big player again in D.C. and everything that's happened in...
Sure. Was in Smallville last season.
Yes, indeed. Yes. It's... I'm glad to
it's
see them back. What else can you do? I mean, it's work for hire, I guess, at the end of the day.
Oh, sure. Well, yes, it is. But, I mean, on things like Arion and Checkmate, I do have creator you know, I do have part ownership, so.
Understood.
You know, if there's toys, there's royalties.
Do they,
in fact, there were Checkmate. Remember the HeroClix?
Yes, of course.
There were a couple of two or three different Checkmate figures in that, and they paid royalties on those things, and they were actually considering that they were three little figures out of 2,000 that were produced. Not bad, so you know.
That's cool.
Let's have more toys.
Well, and my friend Greg Rucka was writing the modern Checkmate series for a little while, as long as it lasted.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I didn't. Did you ever have any contact with Greg about the series?
I did not. Contacted the editor to remind them to put my creator credit in the credits, but no.
I'm sorry to hear that. Well, you know.
No, it was a silly oversight. I mean, the editor was somebody I knew, and it was just, you know, it was just a crush of getting things done oversight that everybody was appropriately embarrassed about. So.
Okay. Well, that's cool. Understood then. And we mentioned before some of your other great comic book deaths that you were responsible for, and one that's still even, I think, playing out today in Jeff John's current story in Brightest Day, and that's the death of Aqua Baby.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something that haunts Aquaman to this day.
In fact, I think that stuff is going to be reprinted soon in a trade paperback along with a whole bunch of the Aquaman stories from that period. I think they're doing that whole chunk of the run in the last few issues of Aquaman and into Adventure Comics.
I was going to say, okay.
Like that.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah. I was going to ask if it was Adventure, and yeah, that sounds right. Back in the Dollar Comics kind of days, or was that even...
Yes, right.
Okay.
Right, it went there. It went into Adventure, and I think Don Newton was drawing it.
Wow.
Yeah, boy, man, those were the days.
Let me tell you.
And then Don Heck took over, which wasn't shabby either.
Indeed. Absolutely. Man, I'll tell you, it's stuff like that, or it was, oh God, and I'm blanking now on the writer, Michael Fleischer.
No,
I was going to say Mike Fleischer and Jim Aparo doing the Spectre and stuff, and
sure.
and also doing Aquaman in Adventure and everything. It just seems like they're, you know, yeah, some of these what would be called, you know, B or C level heroes and stuff had amazing creative teams. And I would say you and Don Newton and Don Heck are certainly in that category as well, where, you know, people could reach back on some of those anthologies and find some really great art teams and creative teams on these books.
Yeah, it was amazing what was showing up. I mean, you know, there was that time in the 70s where, you know, Wally Wood was inking all this stuff at DC, you know, this Rick Estrada stories or whatever. And it was just beautiful. I mean, Wally Wood on anything is lovely to see. But you know, there was a, I don't think there's the kind of, I mean, there's great artists today, don't get me wrong, but everything is so over-rendered and overwrought that, you know, the good old Kurt Swan, Kurt Schaffenberger, Wally Wood, you know, the guys, you obviously grew up on too. You know, I miss that.
I hear you. You know, and I was wondering about something because looking at your bio, you're about 10 years older than me. And it was this has kind of come up in other podcasts and we've kind of talked about it, I think, in the stores and stuff, because I think people forget that my generation and maybe the one underneath me might be the first ones that it'll be interesting to see how long they stay with the books once they reach a certain age. And I wonder, do you read any current superhero fare at all, you know, for pleasure? And if not, I wonder if you can cite when you stopped and why.
I don't read much. I keep track of things. I flip through the books. I know what's going on, but I find them difficult to read. I think they are... for the most part, and even when they're well done, but they're still, everything is just so stretched out. I mean, you know, I can't, I find it difficult to believe that it takes you 22 pages to tell me that little bit of story, you know?
I do understand what you mean, yeah.
The decompressed storytelling is just very difficult. I mean, you know, I'm doing a 24-page Archie story, and I am cramming a lot of stuff in there. You know, I'm dealing with something.
I do know.
Like, I'm dealing with something like 16 or 18 regular characters in every story. I remember that's the same characters, but acting differently in two books.
Right.
I'm packing a lot in there, and I read these things, and the whole issue is spent with two people standing over a tombstone arguing. It's like, come on, let's move it on. We know you can stretch it out and all that, but really, can I have a story, please?
What?
And I find there's a lot of that goes on, and it's all being done for the trades, and it's what the marketplace has turned into, and that's fine. It's just not exactly my market anymore.
I understand.
I read a few things. I think Jonah Hex is great. There's a few books here and there. I like The Flash, but, I'm such a sucker for The Flash.
Me too. That's all right.
I read the Superman books even when I hate them, which is frequently.
Understood, man. I feel exactly the same way. Yeah. Although I think there's a ray of sunshine that Paul Cornell, I love his Luther story, but I do think that I'm reading that Superman will be returning to action very soon. So I think that's a good sign. And I can't wait for Chris Robeson to write his own story. And I'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
I do understand and share your frustration. I loved and I want to ask about your World of Krypton miniseries, but I really did enjoy what James Robinson and company were doing with their spin on the world of New Krypton. And it was, I think, a fun shout back to those stories of the 70s and earlier, really even the Weisinger era, going back to, seeing Superman Time Traveler and his time in Kandor. And I think it touched that kind of feeling for me.
But
I don't know. I understand what you're saying, though, too, about how stories do take their sweet time. And even you're working in a 6-part arc format as well. But as you say, I think you are cramming a hell of a lot of story in every issue. I never feel like I'm reading a middle issue of one of your books, for example.
Yeah. I mean, to me, an issue should resolve, even if it doesn't resolve anything, it should resolve something. It should have a beginning, middle, and end. It can continue, but there should be something should end and give you a feeling of an ending at the end of the story.
Sure.
Of all things. That's what I try to do. I try to kind of build, a story that will have a beginning, middle, and end, but in the meantime, threads of all the other stories travel through it, and you follow those as well. But
understood.
At least you don't go home hungry.
Now, I noticed that you wrote the World of Krypton miniseries, and in some circles it's considered one of the first comic miniseries.
It is, as far as I know, the first comic miniseries, although it was not meant to be a comic miniseries. It was meant to be a 3-issue run in Showcase.
Oh, okay.
But Showcase got canceled. And then the Superman movie was coming up, and they needed Superman product, so they said, well, let's just put it out, in 3 issues. I don't even think that the term miniseries was used at the time.
Okay. Well,
so it's an accidental miniseries.
Who was your artist for that series?
In the credits, it says Howard Chaykin. In reality, it was Alan Kupperberg.
Okay. Oh, wow.
Howard. Alan ghosted for Howard a lot, and Murphy Anderson inked the first 2 issues, and was it Frank McLaughlin or Frank Chiaramonte or one of those guys? Somebody named Frank.
Understood.
Inked the third one.
Okay. Wow. And, I loved, I remember when World of Krypton was a backup series back in the 70s, and it was always great sword and sorcery kind of tales.
Yeah.
And, basically even centuries before, Jor-El's time on Krypton and stuff. But
it was just
a great opportunity to kind of explore the backdrop of Krypton in the ancient times. And, have that great combination of science fiction and sword and sorcery.
Yeah.
What was your story? I'm sure I read it, actually, because anytime it said World of New Krypton, I was there. So remind me, what was that story about?
It was Jor-El's life story.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it was just doing the detailed life story of Jor-El as could only be done by someone who was being edited by E. Nelson Bridwell.
Very cool.
Who, knew every single. He was an assistant editor at DC. It started for Mort Weisinger in the early 60s, and was working for Julie Schwartz by the time I got around there. Nelson knew more about continuity than any man alive, and used it in the stories. So he would edit stuff into my scripts that required footnotes to explain.
I understood.
But it was very. I later on did a Secrets of the Legion of Superheroes miniseries that he also edited. So he did the same thing to me, except with 92 characters instead of just Jor-El.
I'm a big Legion fan as well. Back then, and I've talked to other writers of that period, and actually maybe a little earlier, guys like Elliot Magan and Denny O'Neill and mm-hmm. people like that, but they had said that some of their scripts would really become more of a collaboration between editor and writer.
Sure.
Tell me about that.
A guy like Julie Schwartz he's Julie Schwartz. if he edited my script, he had a reason. He's Julie Schwartz. I grew up on Julie, and Julie remains the editorial god in comics to me. I mean, Stan's reputation is not as an editor, it's as a writer and a creator.
Sure.
Julie was, I think the greatest editor of comics. And he was, incredible to work with. And he was a very strong personality because he came from an era when you didn't question the editor. And, when he started working with guys like Len and Elliot and Marv and then a little later myself and, other guys, and we'd sit there and go, no, what, are you crazy? He'd go, I'm Julie Schwartz. What do you mean? He gradually, you knew when Julie trusted you because he let you win an argument, That's when you knew you were in with him and okay. But a lot of the times, I'd walk in and I have a great idea for a story. And I go, okay, Superman does, this, that, and the other thing. And he goes, oh, that's great. But what happens if it's actually a purple alien who's wearing the dress and not Lois? And then we'd go off from there and develop an entirely different story.
Fair enough. Okay. Yeah. And how much did that, kind of experience influence your time as an editor? Because I looking at your bio and everything, it says from 91 to 2006. And some of the titles you were on were The Flash, Wonder Woman, Jack Kirby's Fourth World, Impulse. I'm sure a few others. And, mm-hmm. yeah, so, working with that different generation of writers and stuff, how much it changed?
It was a different, a whole different world and a whole different way of doing things. And, I was also very fortunate for the most part on something like, Wonder Woman. First I was working with William Messner Loebs as the writer.
Fantastic, sure.
It's like that doesn't require a lot of work. And then after Bill's run, after the Mike Diodato, Bill Loeb's Artemis run, John Byrne took over. And, John is a guy you just hand him the keys and you walk away.
Gotcha.
You don't have to worry. He's going to deliver finished pages, and they're going to be great, and they're going to be on time. On Flash, I had Mark Waid, Grant Morrison, Mark Miller, what I tried to do was hire really good people and get out of their way because I'm very lazy and there's less work I had to do.
Understood. And did you also work with John Byrne on the Jack Kirby Fourth World stuff? Okay,
yeah.
Go on. You were going to say something. I interrupted you there.
No. I'm just saying that I'm just, I'm very lazy. So, when you have talent like that you can rely on, you don't have to worry about doing the work. They'll do it for you. John, I'm fortunate. John's an old friend. We go back to fan days, in the early 70s. So, I always knew I could call on him.
Understood. Well, I'm curious about working with Mark Miller back then, because that was pretty early in his run. Was Graham Morrison also writing for you on The Flash?
Yeah. I mean, Mark was already writing for 2000 AD and, you know, the British comics
right.
when he got to me. But, you know, I kind of broke Mark in American comics. He and Grant pitched a superhero series called Aztec to me. And it was a beautiful proposal. I mean, procedure, I handed it into the senior editors to read and approve. And Denny O'Neill, who was one of those at the time, returned it to me with a note saying, "This is the best proposal I've ever read."
Wow.
So I was working with baby Mark Miller when he was just breaking in, and he was in his, I don't know, he was 20, 21, and he had grown up reading my comics, and, you know, so I was kind of like, it was a little like fanboy experience for him, you know, so.
No, that's cool.
But, he was always a talented, exciting writer, you know, he always loved his, you know, loved the projects he was working on. And, you know, I still follow his stuff. I still think he's, you know, a really good writer and an amazing marketer.
Yes, indeed. I know. I spoke to him in the fall about Clint Magazine and certainly his movie ambitions that are going on, not only with Kick-Ass, but some of the other projects that are on the slate and everything. So, yes, he's a good communicator when it comes to promoting his own ideas, and it's always fun to talk to him. And I think he's an interesting creator, so that's
he is
very, very neat. And I want to again trip back to Adrian Chase and Vigilante, because now Marv Wolfman, did he start writing the series? How did that all work out exactly? Because I know he created the character for
Marv
Titans.
Marv created Vigilante and wrote the first 15, 16 issues of the book. And then I came in to do some fill-in work, and after I did the fill-in work, I then came back an issue or two later to dialogue for some stories for Marv, because he was, you know, he was overworked at the time.
Sure.
And all of a sudden, I went from dialoguing it to, "Why don't you just write this from now on?" So, you know, okay.
Well, that was one of those great direct market, you know, titles from DC.
Yeah.
And I think also the design of the character's costume as well, I think, kind of helped, because it was such a departure from your average superhero comic look for the day. But then it really did kind of, you know, reach this point of and I'm curious to hear creatively, was the book canceled? I mean, how did you guys lead to that ultimate fate of Adrian Chase?
Well, in something around number 34, number 35, the character guns down a policeman. It's a mistake, but Vigilante kills a cop.
Right.
And that was kind of like, well, you know, now he has done the ultimate, you know, thing. You know, he can't live with that, and that was the beginning of his decline. And after a few months, the editor and I just kind of started thinking, well, you know, the only way to take him is into deeper crazy. And the deeper into crazy he got, and the more irrational he got, we finally realized, you know, he's got to end. And it's ridiculous now to bring another guy to wear the suit. You know, we've done that. He got killed off.
I remember that, yes. And even a woman, you know, for a while, correct? Did the female vigilante?
Well, that was later.
Oh,
that
excuse
was,
me.
That
okay.
Was later, not in my run.
I see. Okay.
This was a character who was a court bailiff who wore the suit for a while.
Right. Okay.
But anyway, we just reached the point where we went into the, you know, higher-ups and said, this guy's got to kill himself. This guy's got to commit suicide, and we got to cancel the book, you know. And, you know, so we canceled ourselves. You know, there was really nowhere else to take the character or the book. And fortunately, they didn't want to lose the kind of spot, the feel of the book and the spot on the schedule. So they had us create a spinoff, which was Checkmate, from the book. After it was canceled.
I had forgotten that Checkmate spun out of Vigilante. Very interesting. Totally forgot that. Okay, because what I remember most, of course, was the issue where he does kill himself. I remember the cover, especially, of him kind of looking at himself in the mirror and, you know,
yeah,
reaching that ultimate conclusion. And then your postscript as well, I thought, was very, you know, poignant. And again, this is just from memory, but I do remember thinking the whole time, there's you know, very few times that I think a comic book really, you know, disturbs you. And I think in an effective way, and I think obviously you guys were successful in doing that. Was it 42 or 43 that Vigilante went to? Something like that.
50.
Oh, it was 50. It was the 50th issue. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Man. So, yeah, interesting. And, what kind of feedback did you get back in the day?
It was... It made a splash. You know, people... you know, people notice it. That, you know, to have a title character commit suicide and you know, and then cancel the book. You know, that didn't happen a lot.
Yeah.
Still doesn't, actually.
Sure. Well, I noticed too in during your editorial run, you were overseeing some novelizations, and some of them were really great that I remember from the last 10 years. In particular, I really enjoyed the Green Lantern series that
you
edited.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Chris Priest and several others writing great chapters of that that story. I loved.
Yeah, that was a trilogy, yeah.
Yeah.
Those thank you. Those were fun. I love comic book novelizations. I've written a few. I've collected them my whole life. I must have, you know, 400 or 500 of them, including kids books and stuff. But yeah, I got to work with Christopher Priest on that. He plotted the three books and wrote the third one in the trilogy. And Marv Wolfman, speaking of which, did a novelization of Crisis on Infinite Earths that was that did really well. It was one of the only, I think, it was the only book that iBook ever published that went back to a second printing.
Oh, that's fantastic! Wow.
Yeah.
Now, is that iBooks? Was that Byron?
Byron Price. Yeah,
yeah, Byron Price's company. Yeah, poor Byron Price, that unfortunate death and everything. I know a lot of comic creators that worked with him and had nothing but great things to say about him.
He was a good guy. I like Byron. He was known him for a long, long time, you know, from the fan days back in the 70s and such. But in fact, I had written a Justice Society of America novel that was going to press the week that iBooks went bankrupt and closed their doors.
Wow.
So,
that
never got published.
Well, that's too bad. That's a shame. So, you know, I mean, it sounds like, you know, between your eBooks and what you're doing for Archie and stuff, that's seems like a reasonably full plate in terms of what you're writing these days. Are there any other projects that we should talk about that we haven't?
Well, you know, unless you want to talk about my Penguins of Madagascar coloring books.
well, that's nice. Well, that's a good, you know.
Yes, I write coloring books for this company, and they have the DreamWorks contract, so I've been doing, like, Megamind, and I should be getting work on Kung Fu Panda 3 shortly.
Fantastic.
So, you know. So look for that at a coloring book store near you soon.
Outstanding. Well, again, I think anyone has to do is look on the racks and see, again, the work that you're doing on Archie and reach back and see some of the great stuff that you've done in the past with DC. Didn't even mention the Superboy and Supergirl runs that you had pre-crisis.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So, you know, hey, man. A lot of good stuff. A lot of good reading from Paul Kupperberg back in the you know, pre-crisis DC years. And then, of course, as we just said, as an editor of so many great books in the last 15 years and now doing great work for Archie. So that's great, man.
Thank you.
My pleasure. And seriously, a pleasure talking to you and continued success with the Archie series. Really enjoying The Married Life. And it sounds like you've got a lot of fun stuff coming up with that. And hopefully we'll be able to check back in and talk a little bit more about some of these books that we just kind of glossed over. And I'd love to hear about your time at DC during this that interesting period, because I think that late 70s through, you know, the early 2000s, I guess, really the Jeanette Kahn years were pretty.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
I was in the office the day Jeanette first showed up and got fired in the implosion and put together the canceled comic cavalcade I have a history.
Wow. All right. Well, there you go. You know something? We will end on that cliffhanger. And honestly, yeah, maybe a few months down the line or something like that, we'll pick up on maybe the next Archie series and have an opportunity to talk about some of those DC years and some of the experiences there. It'd be great to hear about it.
Happy to talk to you.
That's Paul Kupperberg. Don't forget, you can find Archie the Married Life on newsstands right now, plus his ebooks through Buffalo Avenue Books and Smashwords. Again, the titles Two Tales of Atlantis and his anthology collection In My Shorts. Great stuff from Paul Kupperberg, and I think we can promise a return visit from Paul because, as we said, so many other DC memories that we haven't even talked about yet, plus more about what's going on in the world of Riverdale, in the adult world of Archie, the Married Life. Thanks again for listening to this edition of Word Balloon. John Suntress saying that you can find Word Balloon all over the internet. Don't forget, we are at wordballoon.com. We provide at least weekly shows and updates. Also at iFanboy, and our archive is at iTunes as well. Please subscribe to the feed. That way you won't miss an episode of Word Balloon. And as I said at the mid-break of the show, we've got the Word Balloon hotline. So if you have any questions or comments about the show and want to be on the air, then feel free to leave me a voicemail. The number again is 312-841-7025. 312-841-7025. And give us your 2 cents on what you think of Word Balloon or what's going on in the world of comics, and we will pop those comments on the air. We will begin airing various comments starting with our next episode. Of course, if you want to reach me via email or just through text, you can always email me at john@wordballoon.com. Follow me on Twitter under my name, John Wordballoon, and send me a message there, or at my Facebook page under my name, John Suntress. Until next time, thanks again for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2011.